Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Jillian Lauren had no idea what she was getting into when she wrote her first letter to prolific serial killer Samuel Little. All she knew was her research had led her to believe that he was good for far more murders than the three for which he had been convicted. While the two exchanged dozens of letters and embarked on hundreds of hours of interviews, Lauren gained the trust of a monster. After maintaining his innocence for decades, Little confessed to the murders of 93 women, often drawing his victims in haunting detail as he spoke. How could one man evade justice, manipulating the system for over four decades? As the FBI, the DOJ, the LAPD, and countless law enforcement officials across the country worked to connect their cold cases with the confessions, Lauren's coverage of the investigations and obsession with Little's victims only escalated. New York Times bestselling author and lead of the Starz docuseries Confronting a Serial Killer, Jillian Lauren delivers the harrowing report of her unusual relationship with a psychopath. But this is more than a deep dive into the actions of Samuel Little. Lauren's riveting and emotional accounts reveal the women who were lost to cold files, giving Little's victims a chance to have their stories heard for the first time. The book that we're featuring this evening is Behold the Monster, Confronting America's Most Prolific Serial Killer, with my special guest journalist and best-selling author, Jillian Lauren. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Jillian Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for this interview. Congratulations on this book, Behold the Monster.
Thank you so much. It has been a treacherous journey in many ways, and one of great enlightenment as well. And I can't wait to see what this next incarnation of it looks like. I can't wait for it to get out into the world.
Let's start with, as you do, Los Angeles, October 2017. You were writing a mystery novel, How to Saw a Girl in Half, with reference to Elizabeth Short's famous murder. You write that every cold case in Los Angeles has a custodial detective. Tell us about legendary robbery, homicide division, cold case special section detective Mitzi Roberts, and what she talked to you about, specifically a case that you became ultimately involved with.
Yes, ultimately very involved with, entrenched with. But you missed a piece there, Dan, because you said Elizabeth Short, and not everybody knows that that is the Black Dahlia, which is probably the most famous cold case of all time. A young white woman was found tortured, bisected, exsanguinated in a field in Lamart Park in Los Angeles, and the media went wild, and it was never solved. There are several plausible theories, but it will never be solved. And the detective who took the case, no one wants that case, okay? No actual detective who's working homicide wants to be the custodial detective of the Black Dahlia case, because it means you're going to get calls every day from some kook who thinks it was their dad, and you're obligated to follow up on those tips. I used to joke around with the cops that I was just going to call in a new Black Dahlia tip every day.
Right.
I was just going to like call in the car. It's just like, I know it was my mother-in-law who killed the Black Dahlia. Right. But what I got was an interview. And I got that through writer Michael Connelly, who has served as a mentor to me through my career. And I decided I was going to do a departure. I was writing a novel. And, you know, in some ways, I was having a blast. I was interviewing these detectives. I got this famous detective do an interview with me through Michael. He was like, she's okay. This one's all right. You can talk to her. And at the very end of the interview, I said, what are you the most proud of? And she said, I am proud of them all. But I did catch this serial killer once. And that was pretty cool. And that was what sort of set me on the very beginning of the Yellow Brick Road.
Tell us about this traveling down Yellow Brick Road and this opportunity, you say, of a lifetime. And also that you landed in the middle of an ongoing investigation. Tell us more about what you learned about Samuel Little and this case.
Well, I was like, what serial killer? What are you talking about? This is kind of my thing. So how have I never heard of this guy? And she said, well, you know, we nailed him in the late 2000s for three murders from three DNA hits working at the cold case special section at Robbery Homicide Division, which is the fancy LA detectives that you see on TV. That's right. Them. Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard. Renee Ballard is actually Mitzi Roberts. That's who the character is based on. And they're running evidence. They're running old evidence on a Department of Justice grant as forensic, as DNA fingerprinting and forensic science advanced. All of a sudden, these cold cases that were so hard to connect through traditional gumshoe work, because they were often stranger murders, transients, you know, how are you going to connect them? All of a sudden, here comes this way. So they got one, two, three, and then there was a manhunt across the country to catch this guy. Because is he still killing people? I mean, and for how long? They ran his rap sheet, and the DA, the deputy DA, Beth Silverman, who prosecuted the grim sleeper, Chester Turner, like almost every serial killer who was operating in the 80s and 90s in Los Angeles, said she'd never seen a rap she liked it before in her life. You know, he was arrested day after day after day after day for petty theft, for assault. And for every, well, and for murder and for kidnapping and got off again and again and again. So altogether, Samuel Little had a 60-year crime career, and almost 40 of it included serial killing, included sexual serial killing.
What do you do with this information? You talk about New York Magazine and talking to an editor there. What does this book, Behold the Monster, what did it first start off as?
Well, I just skipped a step there because I skipped to the amount of murders I knew many months later before I started the case. All I knew is that there were three he was convicted for, and that the detective who had nailed him and the deputy district attorney and many of the other detectives thought there were many more murders across the country. I had no idea the scope of the carnage when I started. I thought I'd write an article. Maybe I'd turn up some evidence that there were more Sam Little related murders across the country. I'd get some heat on it. And then maybe local jurisdictions would be inspired, or family members would come forward, or, you know, would start to pursue these cold cases again. That was really my goal. Like, I didn't go in there to start solving murders. I didn't go in there to insert myself into the middle of a FBI investigation. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. I went in to talk to Sam Little, and I also thought, what a splashy story. Here's an underreported serial killer. Maybe I can say, oh, there are these other victims, if I can get this guy talking. And that's kind of my thing. You know, like, if I have a superpower, that's sort of it.
Right.
And so I'm like, if anyone can do it, I can figure an angle into this guy. I didn't take it lightly. I studied what I was doing. I studied successful confessions of serial killers in the past.
Right.
You know, I studied all kinds of interview techniques. You know, I looked at the brilliant work of Hugh Ainsworth and Stephen Michaud,
right,
who did the interviews with Bundy where they got him to confess in the third person. And because you're so smart, I just read those words of theirs over and over again. You're so smart. You know, we bet you could analyze somebody like this.
Right.
And then got him talking about himself that way. And I was like, that was a turn of brilliance. Now, I had that in my back pocket. You know, I had a few different ideas, but I was like, I'm going to get this guy talking. And then I thought, you know, and if I can't, then I spent a lot of research, but not a ton. And I wrote some letters to a serial killer, and I'm going to walk into a men's maximum security prison, and I've never seen one before. So let's give it a shot. And that's how it started. It didn't start with any possible idea of what the horizon is.
So tell us how you exactly contacted him before we talk about your visit, where he was imprisoned, and talk about the actual meeting with Samuel Little.
So Samuel Little was incarcerated and had been there since 2014, since his conviction at the California State Prison, Los Angeles, which is actually in Lancaster, which is about an hour and a half from my house. And in order to get in on a visiting day, you have to leave at about 4:30 in the morning.
Right.
And when I contacted Lori Abraham at New York Magazine, and I said, I think I have this underreported serial killer that I could maybe start contacting, and maybe I get a story out of. And she said, you know, we're not going to just do some gruesome serial killer story. You know, we're not doing something sensationalist. We're not doing something exploitative. Like, come back at me with an angle. And I'm like, okay. So I wasn't sure what that was yet, but I'm like, here's my angle. I'm going to start writing him some letters. So I started writing him letters, and you have to request, giving you all my professional secrets here, you need to request, you know, visitors admission. And it takes about 6 months to get one.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do you have to request it, I mean, your inmate has to request it. So
yes,
you know, as I waited for that to come through, I sort of slowly massaged a rapport with him and listened to his professions of innocence, 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 innocence. And I just was waiting to get face to face before I started to contradict that or to challenge it in any way. You know, but I said, you know, I do think if you're innocent of these crimes, and in fact, you're just a very unlucky guy who happened to be at all of these places. That's, you know, just because my DNA was there doesn't mean I killed her. Just means I was there. I'm just an unlucky guy. But I mean, he stopped all that once he started confessing and began to really embrace his crimes more than deny them. I mean, he was long past any appeals, and he knew he was going to die soon. He was no man. So die famous or die in obscurity. And I think he decided to die famous.
Tell us about James Holland. You call him, some people have called him the Space Cowboy. He's a Texas Ranger.
And only I called him the Space Cowboy.
Okay. Sorry.
I'll only call him, that's my personal nickname for him. I mean, one of the things I do in the book is that, like, reveal my process, right, as a journalist.
Right.
You know, I don't just say like this, and this happened. I'm like, here's my journey of figuring out how this happened and how to talk to these people. But one of the ways I remember people, remember their names, I give them funny nicknames in my head. And when Texas Ranger James Holland met Samuel Little, Samuel Little thought me and Texas Ranger James Holland was in the big tall hat and the cinco peso star and the whole thing. And Sam Little said, what are you, some kind of cowboy from Mars? So then in my notes, he became the space cowboy. Then that winds up in the book. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that makes it unique, you know, is that it's an unfolding. So you asked me two things. What was it like to meet Sam? What was it like to meet Jim? Sometimes I think it wasn't that different. But what it was like to meet Sam was there was so much drama and pressure. It's one of the largest men's maximum security facilities. It's horribly overcrowded. In the country. It's horribly overcrowded. It is in the middle of the desert with this punishing atmosphere. And you walk the moms and their kids, you walk like about a mile from the visitor's parking lot to the visitor's waiting center. And you wait. And then every single weekend, it seems like there's a new wardrobe, something that you violated. You know, I had to chew my own underwire out of my bra because there are no sharp objects. There are no sharp objects available, and the metal detector kept getting set off. So, you know, like there was that kind of dramatic experience getting into the prison, getting into B block, you know, and then have Sam Little roll up to me in a wheelchair, you know, and talk to me. It was 2 days before he confessed. And, you know, after about a total of 6 hours of conversation. And it would be so easy to say that, you know, it was looking into the eyes of evil, you know, which is what I think that, you know, they love in documentaries, you know. It's like, and it wasn't. It was like talking to a human being. Who I found sort of surprisingly challenging, surprisingly charming, surprisingly, like, I mean, probably not at that point, not that early, but don't know if I've ever wanted to crawl up over a table and kill someone myself. That infuriating.
Right.
Or like, so he could bring me to such depths of, it wasn't him, you know, Sam was an aberration. Like the depths that he brought me to were the stories of the victims and, you know, and how he chose them and how they were treated. You know, he chose them because no one would care. And, you know, the things they said to him and the way that he justified his crimes by his, you know, asking for forgiveness. And so he believed he was forgiven, like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. And I just, you know, said, well, I'm not really not sure that's how it works. I don't know. But that, I could crawl across this table and strangle you myself, you know. But I mean, frankly, most of our conversations were interesting. He was a fantastic storyteller with an incredible recollection, which is something that we shared. And he could recollect times and bring things to life, like, you know, the steel trade in Lorain, Ohio, and the transgender clubs in Miami in the 70s. And, you know, I sort of went on this journey around the country talking to victims' families and talking to law enforcement. And I thought, you know, that knowing somebody like Sam Little, who, I mean, evil's a tough word, but it is the takeaway. You know, at the, you know, the takeaway, he's dead now. It's a couple years and still I wake up and when I hear his voice in my head, it's that takeaway. But that doesn't explain much about how he got away with it, about how whole society participated in it. Law enforcement and, you know, everyone who looked away, you know, and every institution that abused the little boys who were in, you know, reform schools and, you know, possibly like, you know, flipped on all those genes that were in there already. But, you know, what would have happened had not the abuse, had not the head trauma happened? I mean, who knows? Sam says the same exact thing would have happened. He said there was nothing that would have changed him.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We haven't talked about, and you do explore in this undertaking of this book, you talk about the origins of some of the things that he coveted, his paraphilia especially. So you go right back, and it's fascinating when you confront him with the model from Inside Detective that was huge influence in his life and his life of crime. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, Sam Little has a very developed narrative about how necks became his sexual fixation and strangulation became, as he would have said, you know, how sex and death got twisted up inside him.
Right.
He doesn't know. God made him how he was, but that was true. And he knew it from the moment he started seeing. And you see this among serial killers, violent pornography. Doesn't mean A plus B equals C, and everyone who looks at violent pornography is going to turn into a serial killer. There really aren't that many of them statistically within the population, but it does tend to be something that is commonality. And there were these, they weren't quite pornography, and you could buy them. You could buy them at the corner store. You could buy them at the Five and Dime, which was right. The 7-Eleven, and they were True Detective or Inside Detective. And they showed, I mean, I sort of couldn't believe it when I, you know, I started finding like vintage magazine dealers. And I was like, I'm going to find this one. He was obsessed with these and he would steal them. And there was this one story about a woman named Gloria Ferry. Gloria Ferry ran off from her home where she was poor and abused when she was 16 with her boyfriend, who's much older than her. And then she tried to leave him. She went to work at a laundry in Cleveland. He strangled her to death for the crime of leaving him. And left her in the park. And there were a couple of magazines that featured this story. And Sam became obsessed. And he became obsessed with the picture in particular of Gloria Ferry, blonde. She was wearing pearls and had this very long neck. And he'd been looking at necks since he was 5. And there was a little girl in class, Carol Messenger, a little redhead girl, who used to make funny faces at him, and he would fantasize about putting his hands around her neck. And then there was a teacher that he fantasized about in the 3rd grade and her neck. And, you know, he had this whole narrative. And sometimes always, I questioned his veracity, and his narratives were so colorful and, you know, so I checked my work. And one of the things that made me think that maybe this whole thing was made up was Carol Messenger, the little redhead girl. And I was just thinking, who's the little redhead girl? What does that sound like? And I was like, that's Charlie Brown. That's the crush in Charlie Brown. That's the crush in Peanuts, is the little redhead girl. And right. I was like, did he make the whole thing up? Except that, no, I've corroborated it. And also I found these magazines. I found 1954 Inside Detective, 1955 True Detective. Maybe switch those around. I'm not sure. One or the other. I found two, and there was the story of Gloria Ferry, and there was the picture he described. So by the time I brought him that picture, he was already in Texas. He was confessing to the FBI. He'd been extradited to Texas. He was in a sheriff's, he was in a county jail in Wise County. I mean, I sort of couldn't believe it. I was like, what? This looks, there's more security at my kid's high school.
Wow. Yeah.
And I did get to go and interview him there. And I showed him the Gloria Ferry pictures. And he was just like, where did you get these? And where did, like, how? And I was like, you want them? You know, you want these pictures? Well, then, you know, I want things too. I mean, and that is what it was always like with Sam and me, you know? He was like, I want a TV. I was like, cool, I want things too, you know? I want a story.
You push him finally. You say you're sick of the BS. And so you say you wanted something. You wanted to know things like, how did it feel to kill? You wanted to know some serious things, and you wanted some serious information from him.
Yeah. So when I got those magazines, and when I was able to make copies and get him the pictures he wanted, and said a vile thing to do, perhaps, I don't know, but I said, tell me about Denise in Odessa, you know? And, you know, it gave me one of the more detailed stories I've gotten from him. It's, you know, one of my favorite chapters in the book, although I can't read it. I don't know if I can read it again. As many times as I've been over it and copy edited it and, you know, and quoted it and showed it to people, there was a moment a few days ago when I was like, I don't think I can read the Denise chapter on tour. I don't think I can look at it again. It was just, you know, it was told to me in such detail. And it was also going back to the Texas Ranger James Holland, who is this sort of legendary, you know, serial killer whisperer and works multi-jurisdictionally within Texas. But if he has a Texas case that's connected to a case in another state, that gives him jurisdiction there as well. So he was able to locate the Denise Brothers case, and that is what brought him to Sam. Now, Texas Ranger James Holland and I happened to come upon the same serial killer at the same time. So that was how I got involved in the FBI investigation.
Now, the thing is that at one point, Samuel Little confesses and says that he has killed 93 women. Mm-hmm. So the task for the FBI, James Holland, and for you as well, is to get confirmation somehow.
Well, I mean, that's also for local jurisdictions.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm not a detective. So although that did turn out to happen, it's not, you know, I didn't go in as a citizen sleuth.
Right.
I went in as a journalist. And it just so happened that as he was confessing to me, you know, there were a number of cases where I was asking unusual questions and I would get details that perhaps the cops weren't getting. So I was communicating with law enforcement about the conversations we had about particular murders. And there were a handful that my details were the linchpin that solved the case. But I didn't, you know, go in there to go solve murders. I just started to learn as I went.
So it's an interesting relationship you have, because the Texas Ranger and the FBI are cautioning you, but at the same time, they're respecting your journalism and its effect, and also the results that you garnered from the interviews with Samuel Little.
Yes, and the LAPD as well. And like I said, and local jurisdictions, you know, right. I had really amazing experiences with detectives across the country. And there are detectives, you know, in small jurisdictions who are the only cold case department. There is. I've asked, I was like, well, how many people are in your cold case department? Me, you know, on my spare time. So much of the time, it's a work of passion for detectives, these people who didn't get justice, and they tend to be the good ones. So, I also interviewed people who, you know, and law enforcement officers who ignored the claims of marginalized women in the 80s and didn't, I did more confrontational interviews as well, but I was helped by local cops all across the country at the FBI. And journalists and law enforcement have a classically tense relationship because my job is to find stuff out. You know, my job is to hold people accountable, and law enforcement tends to be a very cloistered community, and they would much rather like you just go away and let them do their job. I mean, they said as much to me, you know, like, thank you, young lady, for your help. Why don't you go let law enforcement do their job and stay in your lane? I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I'm dug in here, you know, and I have an exclusive with a serial killer who's in the middle of 93 confessions. Now, those 93 confessions weren't to me, you know,
right.
I would say maybe in the 30s, I would say I got, you know, of like detailed confessions from him. He was confessing to law enforcement, and I was focusing on cases I was doing a deeper dive. Wasn't my goal to get every single confession out of him. That was already being done.
How many were confirmed soon? And then how many were confirmed shortly after or out of those 93?
There were about 35 confirmed very quickly. Which was one of the things that really, and I, you know, saw the process of how they confirmed it and how precise and meticulous they were about it, you know, and this includes the data analyst, Dr. Christy Palazzolo from the FBI and Dr. Angela Williamson from the DOJ. It wasn't just Texas Ranger James Holland, but, and local PDs that, you know, I was convinced that they were doing their work and doing it properly. And 35 happened fast. I mean, now it's 2023 and we're at 63, I believe. And I just got to move. I have a map with pins in it that I made at the beginning because it was so hard to sort of imagine the carnage. And also I wanted to sort of see his pattern across the United States because he was a drifter. He was a traveler. He traveled mostly on the 10 back and forth across the United States, theft by day, murder by night. So I made this map and the red pins in it are for the victims that I know that are still unsolved, and the black pins are solved. And I got to change one out the other week, and it's been a while. And believe that this book coming out, you know, I have the most comprehensive list of Sam Little's victims that I know of out there. It's all in the book. I believe that we're going to see solves. You know, we're going to see action and also awareness, and hopefully, you know, I'll entertain you and grab you from the first page to the last, because that's how you get people to care.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear from our sponsor. You know what helps me sleep well at night? Physical gold. I'm concerned about what the current administration is doing and decided to learn more about gold IRAs to help me diversify. You can buy gold for your IRA 401k. Gold can't be tracked like digital currency. No one has to know what you're buying. There's no way to print more. My best resource for gold IRAs is Augusta Precious Metals. Their track record is no less than phenomenal. They have thousands of happy customers. They are the absolute best. They are amazing. Learn why thousands of Americans are getting gold IRAs as part of their retirement portfolios. You need to contact Augusta Precious Metals and get their free guide. I'm serious. Text DAN to 68592. Again, text DAN to 68592. DAN at 68592 or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. That's AUGUSTA PreciousMetals.com. Now, what you write about is incredible. There are living victims. There are some victims that escaped the clutches of Samuel Little, and specifically a woman that fought him, and you write that boxed him. Also, that you had alluded to it, and well, you had mentioned it, but you go explore how on earth this guy, even though he was a major suspect in so many of these murders, that even with grand jury indictments, those failed, trials failed, even with living victims like the one you chronicle, Lila McLean, Bowlegs. Can you tell us just this incredible story that really demonstrates and illustrates what Samuel Little was all about?
Well, there were four victims who survived Samuel Little's attacks. The first two were Hilda Nelson and Lila McLean in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Pascagoula, Mississippi in the late 80s was on fire. There was an area, it's a rural part of Mississippi, there was an area called Carver Village where you could get anything you wanted. And on half of the street was the front, and on the other half of the street was the projects. And on the front was where there were pool halls and juke joints and music and prostitutes and guns and drugs and teas and blues and anything you wanted all night long. And people would come from all over the South to come to Carver Village. Now, the women who lived in the projects often worked as prostitutes. And the two women who survived there, the first one, Hilda Nelson, who is the woman who I interview in my book. I have the only interview with her, only interview she ever gave. She and her friends had a pact that, you know, if you walked up into your room with a man and it took longer than 15 minutes, somebody would come and they were breezeways, you know, like walkways, like two-story buildings, walkways. Somebody would come and knock on your door. And so her best friend came and knocked on her door, and a man's voice answered, like, she's fine, she's handling her business. But that wasn't their deal. So Dolores was her friend's name, walked around the back, and they had window fans. You know, it was hot. It was Mississippi. It was the summer. She kicked in the window fan, and Sam was strangling Hilda in the bathtub with a scarf and drowning her. And Sam just stood up and walked out. And so she was saved by her friend. Now, she didn't report this, but word started to get around amongst the women. And just a few years later, Sam picked up a 5-foot, 2-inch spark plug named Layla McLean, who ran Pool Hall, which was in the back, was a brothel where you would rent rooms. And she was also a prostitute, and she got in a car with Sam, and she told him where to go. And he's like, no, I'm going somewhere else. And she immediately saw that he was not going where he said he was going. And this woman is the only woman who fought him off out of 93. I mean, plenty of women fought him. And she just, I mean, at the trial, she said, I learned to box because I had too many stepbrothers. She took her foot and put it on the gas and took the wheel and tried to drive the car into a wall. And then she boxed him. I mean, they said, how many doors were in that car? She said, I know there were four because I was in and out of them so many times. You know, like I ran, he grabbed me. Finally, she got away. She ran across four lanes of traffic, and the shipyards that were there were getting out. It was a change of shift. I was there. I stood there. Like, it was crazy, four lanes of traffic. And it was so long. And she ran back to the front and she tripped over some man who's peeing in the bushes. Smokey Joe was peeing in the bushes and he grabbed her and dragged her to the front. And they took her to the hospital where she stayed for 3 days. Many, many years later, she lived to testify about it, though she tried before that. And, you know, I will just never forget them saying, you showed up at a hospital with petechial hemorrhaging in your eyes, which is what happens when you're strangled. It's the blood vessels in your eyes break. And, you know, and you couldn't speak for 3 days and you had bruises around your neck and you'd been hit in the head so many times you couldn't see. Did you report what happened to you? And she said, no, ma'am. And the prosecutor said, let me put this another way. Did any doctor ask you what happened to you? And she said, no, ma'am. And she said, well, why didn't you report it? Why didn't you talk to them afterward? And she said, well, I'm going to walk down to the police station in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and said I was working as a prostitute and I was assaulted. I'd wind up in jail. They don't know why I'm down there. They don't know who I am or what I'm working. And, you know, and you couldn't commit a crime against a Black prostitute in Mississippi at that time. It simply wasn't considered a crime. And their testimony was never subpoenaed until, well, eventually they both did go report it. Their testimony was never subpoenaed until a white girl went missing. Her name was Melinda Lepree, and they connected him to Sam. When they showed up at the courthouse, Hilda was 8 months pregnant. They showed up to testify at Melinda Lepree's grand jury indictment. And Hilda took one look at Sam and she urinated on the floor. And they made her clean it up. And they sent them home without testifying. So it wasn't until they testified at Sam's trial in 2013 that they finally got to tell their story. So Layla McLean, Hilda Nelson, there was another victim, Lori Carriage in San Diego, who testified then and testified again in LA. Sam served 18 months on was initially attempted murder, kidnapping, assault, rape. He did some time for kidnapping. Served 18 months and a 4-year sentence. The other victim didn't show up and has never been identified again. And Tanya Jackson, Lori Carriage, still very much alive and is a trauma counselor and living in Portland and works with victims of violent crime. But she is furious, furious that he served 18 months. After having tried to kill her, he left her for dead. He thought she was dead. And she just played possum by the side of the road until he was gone. And, you know, if you really want to hear some anger about how the social justice system treated a woman they felt, you know, was an unreliable witness, in spite of how precise and impeccable her testimony was, as well as the cops involved in the case. In spite of that, he served 18 months. Drove straight to LA and killed two women in one night.
Yes, incredible.
So the book itself, you know, is reaching out toward larger themes, like of, you know, how we pursue social justice, how forensic science can level the field in some ways, but also our attitudes as a society have to change. And it's a story about the fascinating lives of the people involved in this world.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you talk about not seeing Samuel Little, and then he was returned to Los Angeles County, and you had an opportunity to see him again. Tell us about this, the difference in these visits. Tell us about that meeting again.
Well, when he was extradited to Texas, I had an idea that I was rid of him. I mean, that I'd be able to ask him the questions I wanted to ask, because by that time, you know, I was so deep within the investigations. you know, there was no dropping the story for me, but I thought it would be nice to not have to see him again. Like I say, you know, my experiences with him were always, they were everything, you know, I mean, they were interesting. They were ultimately, you know, I think every one of them took a bite out of me, you know, to just have to sit there and look that in the eye. And the fact that I did it for so long, which I also think really gave me a unique perspective. I don't know that there's a journalist that's done that sort of long-term research with somebody where you get to see their personality unfold in so many ways, or say the layers of the onion peeling away. But right. Yeah, when they extradited him to Texas, I thought like, oh, now I don't have to. Now I can just pretend, oh, bummer. Too bad they brought him to Texas. Now, you know, I can't see him all that much. And then, you know, when they gave him the option at the end of it, at the end of the confessions and at the end of his conviction for the murder of Denise Brothers, they gave him the option of where he wanted to be. And he said he wanted to be back in Los Angeles with his journalist. The difference, I mean, every time I talked to Sam was different. There was a time I was working on the documentary. Joe Berlinger, who did the amazing Paradise Lost series, right. You know, the recent Ted Bundy and Jeffrey yes. Dahmer documentaries on Netflix, did a documentary about me working on this book and working on Sam Little's cases. And for that, and also, you know, for my own research, I pretty much talked to Sam on the phone from prison every day. And one of the things I did for the documentary was, you know, I was like they can't always have, you know, a big fancy camera there when every moment of something real happens in a true crime story or what that relationship was like. So I put a GoPro in my office and every single time I walked in, I turned it on. And I was just like, no matter what, no matter what, no matter how shitty you look, no matter you just like ran in from the pool where you were with your kids, you know, mm-hmm. your hair in a knot, in a bikini. And I'm like, no matter what, just like show what it was like, because that's what it was like. You know, it was like running up from Christmas dinner. And, you know, and I think that Keith, they do a montage in the documentary that shows like how very many times I spoke to him. And, you know, and like what different kind of conditions I was in. They even asked me, they were like, really, like, I mean, we realize this is powerful, but like most people don't want to be, you know, photographed like bent over their desk crying in a bikini. And I was just like, fuck it. You know, I'm not a model. Can I say fuck it?
Yes.
Fuck it. I'm not a model. You know, I was doing my job and I don't care. And, you know, and that is what it was like. It was different every day. And, you know, but as we sort of, you know, COVID started approaching and there were ideas that they were going to start shutting down visitation, you know, he made me his next of kin. And we had an understanding that I was going to donate his brain to science and that I'd do something respectful with the rest of the 200 pounds of him. And then when they did shut down the visiting, very shortly after Sam went into the infirmary with COVID-related symptoms and died there on December 30th, 2020. And it was so, the COVID crisis was so crazy. And there were meat trucks in the parking lot of the coroner's office. And I was never able to get that brain, which is a real shame. What I did get was packages and packages and packages of things that were in his cell. And also I got one surprising letter that I think can sum up in a sense, you know, when people say, what was it like talk to a sociopath, you know, really, what was it like? You know, it was like you were looking at the devil. And I was like, do you think that the devil shows up dressed like the devil? You think the devil's that stupid? You know, like he was a toddler. He was a con man. He was charming. He taught me so much. I'll have nightmares about him for the rest of my life. But at the end of his life, he was testy, you know, he was starting to get fan letter after fan letter after fan letter. And so all of a sudden he's like, well, really, you know, this person's offering me money and, you know, maybe I'm going to tell them my story. I'm just like, shut up, Sam. You know, like, I've been talking to you for years, you know, like I've got your story. But he would shake me down. He was a hustler. He would shake you down to the last minute. And I'm like his last friend. I'm his real friend. I'm the only one who's come to see him in prison. You know, he knows these people are just going to take the drawings, the you know, tracings of his hands he did, the tracings of his penis he did, the drawings people had asked for, you know, for yes. $300 or whatever. Or because they love him, love him, love him, love him. They don't know why I would call him a monster. And in any case, I remember one of our last conversations, he was like, you gave me enough money for ramen, but not a hot pot. Like, you are just, you know, because I put like $15 on his books every once in a while. And, you know, he was like, and not a hot pot. You're just like every one of these bitches. You're this, you're that. I get a letter in the mail. He left me $1,097. I was like, You had money the whole time. And you're shaking down your last friend for $5? Like you can't help yourself. Just doing it to see if you can do it to me. You know? And yeah, that I opened that check and I was just like, fucking Sam. You know, there's a piece that'll be a mystery to me forever. There's a piece that's just he wanted and he took. There are a lot of reasons. Maybe that's what he wanted. You know, I explore them in the book, scientific, psychological. If you figure it out, send me a line.
We haven't talked about it, but you chronicle in this book. And for those that will discover this book, it's incredible. His, to say the least, less auspicious beginning. His grandparents were his parents. His father, he thought, was his brother. And then, kind of echoing Bundy or the Bundy legend, he was told about this at one point in a humiliating fashion.
Sure.
And like you chronicle in this book too, his stay at the boys' industrial reformatory did some shaping in or misshaping his character along the way. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about your extraordinary book, Behold the Monster, Confronting America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. For those that might want to find out further about this, do you have a website and you do any social media?
I do have a website. I do social media and, you know, and I welcome you all to come check it out. And, you know, I try to restore the names and humanity of Sam's victims. Like, come help as well. And please read the book. I'm at JillianLauren.com. There's also a documentary called Confronting a Serial Killer by Joe Berlinger, streaming on most major services right now. I'm on TikTok, Jillian Lauren Author. I'm talking about missing persons. I'm talking about true crime stories. I'm talking about self-defense. And I would love you to look at my TikTok. My Instagram is at Jillian Lauren. TikTok at Jillian Lauren. Facebook somewhere, Jillian Lauren Author. But really, go to my website, pre-order the book, support this effort. I'm very proud of it.
Yes, and indeed you should. Kudos to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for Behold the Monster, Confronting America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening, Jillian Lauren.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.